This is KUT. This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2016. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Protests in Austin over the election of Donald Trump.
I'm having like this wave of calm, you know, so I'm like up and down. Panic, calm, panic, calm, panic, calm.
Which Texas Republicans might serve in a Trump administration?
All these people were either, relatively early supporters of Donald Trump, or they ended up being some of his most vocal supporters.
And a boom in Austin area housing construction concentrated in the suburbs.
The north has been the hottest area of activities, which include Pflugerville, Round Rock, Georgetown.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, don't forget you can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. And that's where you find links to our iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. If you can, leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store. And if you have any questions, you can email me, Nathan@KUT.org, or ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. So much attention was being paid to the presidential election on Tuesday night that you might have understandably missed some of the statewide and local results. So we're going to make sure we're all on the same page. And we're going to get to Travis County, but first let's take a statewide look, where Republicans had a great night. In Texas, however, the margin of victory for Donald Trump was narrower than it's been for Republicans in 20 years. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports on how Texans voted down the ballot.
Texas delivered Republican Donald Trump 38 electoral votes, helping him win the presidency. You could hear Republicans cheering across the state, including at a GOP watch party in Dallas. State Democrats celebrated the fact that they got closer in this race than they have in recent history. Hillary Clinton lost by just single digits here. Her campaign chair in Texas, Gary Morrow, told a crowd it's a big deal.
We have brought this state a long, long way. And I want you to think about that, because we didn't do it because the national campaign sent hundreds of people down here. We didn't do it because they sent millions of dollars worth of TV. We did it because we had great indigenous Texans going door to door and making a difference for Hillary Clinton.
The good news for Texas Democrats kind of ended there. Republican incumbents had a great night in particular. The Republican-led State House and the State Senate will remain under that party's control. Democrats only picked up a few State House seats. The makeup of the State Senate didn't change at all.
It is a tremendous, wonderful night to be a Republican, and especially in Texas.
That's Tom Meckler, the chairman of the Republican Party of Texas. He says a lot was made of Democrats possibly seeing big gains this year. But Meckler says he didn't take it too seriously.
You know, I've heard the Democrats talk about that over and over again. Battleground Texas does it to raise money. And, I mean, we found that during the campaign, when they were making these claims about all the money they were spending in Texas, they weren't.
The GOP also won the hotly contested 23rd congressional district race. That district includes parts of West Texas and San Antonio. Republican incumbent Will Hurd beat back his Democratic opponent Pete Gallego. Hurd thanked supporters just after midnight.
We won this thing because y'all believed that we could win. We won this thing because y'all worked harder, because y'all cared, because this district recognizes that a lot more work needs to be done.
That's not all. Republicans swept positions in the state's highest courts, including the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the Texas Supreme Court. Despite all this, Democrats like Alex Morrison from Austin say they will keep trying to get Democrats elected in Texas.
I campaigned for Obama in 2008. In 2012, I've done it for Clinton now, and I'll keep doing it until I feel like I can have an effect on my community.
GOP Chair Tom Meckler told reporters he anticipates the party will keep its stronghold in Texas for years to come. In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez.
The only statewide race that wasn't for a judge's seat was the race for Railroad Commissioner of Texas. KUT's Mose Bushell has details on this obscure but important election.
The Railroad Commission is a three-member board that actually has nothing to do with railroads. The commission regulates the Texas oil and gas industry. The winner for the empty seat on that commission is Republican Wayne Christian, a former state rep from Center Texas. Christian kept a pretty low profile in the general election. When he spoke publicly, he talked about fighting EPA regulations under the Obama administration. He joins the Railroad Commission just as the agency comes under another sunset review from state lawmakers. That's kind of like an audit that identifies improvements for state agencies. This review identified many, including recommending changing the name of the Railroad Commission to something that reflects what the agency actually does. Mose Mouchel, KUT News.
Okay, Travis County, first of all, turnout was just under 65%. That's lower than 2008, higher than 2012. Remember, though, we had more than 90% of the eligible voting age population registered for the first time ever in Travis. So absolute turnout was 475,000 voters. That was higher than both last two presidential cycles, 70,000 votes higher than 2008. We know, of course, Donald Trump won more electoral votes nationally. Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. In Travis County, it was not close, though. Clinton won 68%. Trump won 27%. Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson got 4%, and Jill Stein had 1% of the vote in Travis County. Locally, there was this very closely watched race, Proposition 1, an offer to people to pay higher property taxes, slightly higher property taxes, in exchange for a $720 million transportation bond. That won easily by nearly a 10-point margin. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has that.
Mayor Steve Adler stood under a Budweiser sign in the loud downtown bar. There, he celebrated an early lead in the bond race, with support at nearly 60% when early voting numbers came out.
I'm not surprised by the margin, but I am very relieved to actually see it. I think that people in this community were really ready for us to start actually addressing the mobility challenges that we have in the city.
And while Adler celebrated, he also stressed the work to come. That's because we don't know exactly what this bond money will fund. We know for the most part where this money will go, most of it to corridors like Guadalupe Street and North Lamar Boulevard. But what changes will come to these streets will be decided by city staff and voted on by council. With lots of public input, says Adler.
The staff is going to be making regular reports to the community so that everybody can track and follow the progress of these projects. I'm just really proud to be part of this community.
City staff estimates homeowners will see about a $5 per month increase in their property taxes. No change will be seen until at least 2018. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
Austin City Council's District 6 has a new council member. Incumbent Don Zimmerman lost to challenger Jimmy Flanagan. Flanagan got 56% of the vote. Zimmerman got 44. And those two candidates had faced off before. Flanagan lost to Zimmerman 2 years earlier. Noting the passage of the transportation bond, Flanagan says he's now looking ahead.
One of the very first things I'm going to do is start holding public meetings about Anderson Mill Road and make sure that the improvements that are included in that bond match the needs and wants of the neighborhoods that drive on that road.
Zimmerman says it's tough for a fiscal conservative to win in Travis County, especially during a presidential year. And he says there's only one thing he would have done differently.
I would have drawn a different marble and run in a non-presidential year. That's what I should have done. But that's the hand of providence, and we accept it.
Zimmerman was one of five city council members who drew two-year instead of four-year terms at the start of the new 10-1 Austin City Council elected 2 years ago. That was when Austin changed its electoral map to have 10 city council members each representing a specific part of the city and one mayor, hence the term 10-1. There were five Austin school board races, and the board has only one new trustee. KUT's Kate McGee explains why that's the case.
In three races, trustees were up for re-election. Amber Ellens in District 5, Ann Teich in District 3, and Jamie Mathias in District 2. In District 7, Yasmin Wagner was running for her seat for the first time. She was appointed to the seat last year after former trustee Robert Schneider died. Of those four races, Mathias was the only one to draw a challenger, Andy Anderson, but Mathias handily beat him. So those four seats will remain the same. The board will see a new trustee in District 8. Trustee Gina Hinojosa vacated the at-large seat when she ran for state office. Cindy Anderson and David Quintanilla ran to replace her, but Anderson won with at least 56% of the vote. With the recent closure of Brown Elementary School for structural problems, Anderson says she expects to talk a lot about facilities over the next 4 years.
We have a lot of schools that are old buildings that have issues. And so I think we have to be very strategic, again, in what we ask our taxpayers for. And considering that we had solutions to overcrowding that were in the form of additions and new builds that did not pass in the last bond, you know, being honest with where we are and what the needs are and being strategic is something we have to be very thoughtful about.
Anderson ran for the school board on her experience. For the past 10 years, she served on various AISD boards and committees and was involved in her children's Austin schools. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Protesters have been marching in major cities across the U.S., including here in Austin, in opposition to Donald Trump's election on Tuesday. The day after Trump was declared the victor, hundreds of protesters marched from the University of Texas campus into downtown Austin. For a while, they blocked the Congress Avenue Bridge in both directions. We went out and spoke to some of those protesters about the presidential election.
My name is Sadia Rashid. I am in grad school here, and I'm studying speech pathology. I was just very anxious and very upset and felt very alone, and to the point where I just didn't even want to wear my headscarf today. I was like, I just don't want to do anything, and I didn't want to get out of bed. For some reason, the world became all Trump supporters to me. I don't know why, and I was walked out of my house today, and I just felt like I was surrounded by people with like hatred in their hearts towards me, and this is just making me a target, and I felt unsafe. I am trying to accept it. I am kind of like in a denial slash accept. I'm like up and down with it, denying like, oh, I hope it gets repealed or something happens, and like all those denial things. I'm having like this wave of calm where I'm like, okay, now we just need to bind together more than ever, and like, you know, so I'm like up and down, panic, calm, panic, calm, panic, calm.
Maddie George, and I am a senior design student here. I'm angry, and I'm sad, and I'm in shock. And I'm at a loss for words, and yeah, I cannot believe it, and it's shocking to me. I feel like I need to wake up right now, but I can't. This is a real thing, and it's terrifying. It is terrifying. I gotta be strong. I have to try to be positive. I know that there are a lot of people who don't have the privilege to feel safe right now, and that it's just my heart is broken, and I'm gonna just try to heal with everybody else, honestly. And doing protests like this is how I'm gonna do it. I don't know.
I'm a junior. My name is Sarah Jones. I've been having this flashback of when I kind of first became aware of politics. It was like the Bush Gore campaign, and just watching how I thought Al Gore would win and that devastation when he lost and what the country went through after the next 8 years from that. And I'm just, honestly, I'm scared. I've kind of realized that right now I just need to be a rock. I can't crumble under this pressure that this man was elected president. Honestly, I'm at a loss of words, and by standing here, I didn't have to say very many words, but I still showed my support.
In that crowd of protesters was Austin City Councilmember Greg Kassar. He joined them on the march after releasing a statement saying he was not calling for healing after the bruising election. He was calling for resistance. So I spoke to Kassar and I asked him what he meant by that.
I'm calling for resistance not just on the part of the city council, but on the part of Austinites and people in so many of our cities who overwhelmingly reject the politics and policies of Trump. As a leader on the city council, it's really important for us to pass inclusive policy that actually helps everyday people. But beyond that, it's also important for us to be leaders out in the streets during the inevitable and important protests and resistance that's going to be happening in our communities. And so I think that while Donald Trump and others are calling for healing, I don't think that what Donald Trump's politics and policies will do will heal anyone. And it's important for us to begin today with the formal resistance against anything Donald Trump asks and directs us to do. From the city council, specifically the city perspective, I will do everything that we have to do to keep all of our families safe in Austin, no matter your background. And so I'm calling on our city government to resist the policies and politics and directives of Trump. I will not stand for Austin police or Austin employees being asked or directed to hurt families in our city.
Can you be more specific, Councilmember Kassar? What types of specific policies are you concerned about, and how could the Austin City Council or the City of Austin resist those policies?
If Donald Trump makes directives, especially in relation to immigration, for the City of Austin to comply in any way with the politics of deportation and tearing apart of families, I absolutely will be calling on our entire city, our community, but especially our City of Austin employees and community to not comply, to pass policies that are not only friendly to immigrants, but to leave civil disobedience on the table.
Now, you, of course, began in politics in the immigrants' rights movement, and you're making a stand here on principle. But as a politician, isn't part of your goal to maximize the interests of your constituents? What you're advocating, some might argue, would be to the greater detriment, even though it might be a stand on your principles.
You know, in the civil rights movement, people did not work with George Wallace to see if they could get the civil rights movement did not work with George Wallace to see if they could get him to be a little bit better. In the short term, Trump is going to be pushing policies and politics that are devastating, not just for immigrant families or for poor families or for families of color, but for all Americans. And it is important that we begin now to push for that level of resistance so that we can win in the long term, because he stands for things that are so unacceptable that we need to begin that all-out resistance. I don't think that there is anything to be gained from trying to negotiate with Donald Trump on these sorts of issues.
George Wallace was not the president of the United States, though, and Donald Trump as president will have tremendous leverage over the city of Austin. One way is in the form of federal funding. Aren't you concerned that Donald Trump, with his leverage over the city, could inflict all sorts of pain if the city of Austin takes such a defiant stance?
I am not scared of Donald Trump, and we have to urge our community to not be fearful of him. It has been his politics from the beginning to sow fear and divisiveness, and he is not going to be bringing any solutions to the American people or to Austin. We will, and it's going to be here in Austin that we can show how effective government works, how we can actually create shared prosperity and fight economic inequality. And Donald Trump will just continue to show that that's not what he stands for and not anything that he intends or is able of doing, capable of doing. And I'm confident that Trump, just like our statewide leaders, will continue to threaten those of us that stand for what is right. And we will continue to work alongside and make decisions alongside those communities that will be most directly affected. Because if we believe in democracy, then we should be making those choices alongside our community members. And I believe that our community is ready to take a strong stand.
Greg Kassar is city council member for District 4. Mr. Kassar, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump is likely to turn to Texas as he looks to staff the executive branch of government. And the Texas Tribune's Patrick Svitek has a list of some of the Texans who could be a part of a Trump administration. Patrick, thanks for talking to KUT Weekend.
Thanks for having me on.
The people on this list all share something in common, right? They were supporters of Donald Trump when it wasn't necessarily a popular thing to be.
Yeah, all these people were either, relatively early supporters of Donald Trump during the general election in Texas, or maybe not early, but they ended up being some of his most vocal supporters in Texas, especially in the home stretch of the election.
Let's start with the one at the top of your list, former Governor Rick Perry.
Yeah, right now I'd consider Rick Perry a serious prospect for the Trump White House. He has said that he's open to serving in the Trump administration, potentially dealing with a longtime passion of his, which is veterans issues or issues dealing with the military. And Trump, months ago said that he'd be open to having Rick Perry serve in his White House. So both men are clearly on the same page about whether Perry could have a role in the White House. And now it's kind of crunch time for those decisions.
Dan Patrick, the Texas Lieutenant Governor, could you see him serving in a Trump administration?
You know, it's not immediately clear what kind of role he could fulfill. There are certainly many different needs that you could see him taking care of for a Trump White House or Trump administration. But he told me today that he actually is not interested in serving in a Trump White House. He actually said that he has already told Trump's transition team that he has zero interest in serving in the administration, but he's happy to provide any kind of advice or input as they look toward Texas to fill some of those roles.
One of the more visible Trump surrogates in the days leading up to the election was Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller. Of course, he's so recognizable when he appears on cable news with his big cowboy hat. Has he expressed any interest possibly serving in a Trump administration?
You know, he's been asked about whether he'd be open to it. He was asked a few days before the election, and he said he was, you know, focused at that time on getting Donald Trump elected. But he didn't rule it out, and he said that, you know, anyone would consider, you know, that kind of offer if it came from the eventual president. But at the time, he said it wasn't his current focus. Obviously, you know, if he were to get some kind of role or be considered for some role, I imagine it would have to do with agriculture issues. He's the agriculture commissioner of Texas, and he served on Trump's agriculture advisory board. So that just makes sense from that perspective.
Austin area Congressman Michael McCaul was a national security advisor for Donald Trump. There's been some talk of, well, he has not ruled out a possible Senate run challenging Ted Cruz in the Republican primary. What do you think is going through his head right now?
You know, he's actually been very open about the fact that he would like a high-level appointment in a Trump White House. He pretty much said as much to National Journal in an interview a number of weeks ago. So, you know, I think that role naturally would involve Homeland Security, would involve national security or some kind of foreign policy issue. So I think McCaul is someone who we can safely say is potentially actively looking for a role in a Trump White House. And he has been advising Trump on these issues. And so it would make sense if he were to fulfill some role, again, that had to do with foreign policy, national security, or homeland security.
Is it possible that President-elect Trump could eventually look to Texas when seeking to fill any Supreme Court vacancies?
Yeah, absolutely. Don Willett, who's a justice on the Texas Supreme Court, was among the judges earlier this year that Trump said he would like to appoint to the U.S. Supreme Court. At the time, Willett did not give any indication whether he was open to serving on the U.S. Supreme Court under President Trump. He just put out a statement saying it was an honor to be on the list. He respects all the other judges and that the list, you know, spoke to the importance of the state judiciary.
Anyone else we should be watching in Texas? Any other politicians or political operatives who could potentially play a significant role in Trump's Washington?
Sure. Well, someone I'm sure who's visible to a lot of people who watch TV is Katrina Pearson. She originally is a Tea Party activist from Garland. She volunteered for Ted Cruz's underdog Senate campaign in 2012. And in November 2015, the Trump campaign named her their national spokeswoman. As I said in the story, the rest is history. Ever since then, she's been on TV nonstop for the Trump campaign, often defending him after he gets engulfed in the latest controversy of the day. And so she's very visible to a lot of people across the country. Again, if Donald Trump plans to run his administration like he ran his campaign, it would make sense for him to have someone as brash and defiant as Pearson in a part of the administration like the press office.
Patrick Svitek is a reporter for the Texas Tribune. You can read his story about this at texastribune.org. Patrick, thanks for your time. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot.
Try to park downtown on a busy Friday, Saturday night. Even during the week, it's not easy. But streamlined technology and more expensive parking spaces are recommended in a new report that tries to look at improving parking in downtown Austin. KUT's Saida Hassan takes a look.
The $260,000 study looks at parking in the area bordered by I-35, MLK, Lamar Boulevard, and Lady Bird Lake, along with the South Central waterfront just across the lake. These preliminary findings stem from a community survey commissioned by the Downtown Austin Alliance, a nonprofit group of local businesses and community members. Jeff Tumlin is with the San Francisco-based Nelson Nygaard Consulting Associates. They surveyed more than 1,300 residents for the study.
One of the things we first wanted to know is, what is Austin wanting to be when it grows up? So we can figure out what kind of a parking system is needed in order to support them. We then went out and collected an immense amount of data to determine the state of parking today. And now we're in the process of developing some recommendations that we align Austin's goals with its parking policies.
The recommendations included streamlining parking rules and technology and keeping a percentage of parking available at all times. Along with the online survey, researchers took a comprehensive inventory of both public and private parking spots. They estimate there are more than 71,500 spaces in the downtown area, but only 6,405 of them are on street parking. Tomlin says street spots tend to be cheaper than garages, which drives high demand, and that can lead to a lot of drivers circling around looking for a place to park.
A majority of respondents have actually experienced trying to come to downtown Austin, not being able to find a space, and giving up on their trip and going someplace else instead.
DeWitt Peart is president and CEO of the Downtown Austin Alliance. He says the goal is to improve how we manage parking going forward, factoring in future growth.
The parking consumes real estate. And so what is the highest and best use of real estate? And should we be really consuming an overabundance of land for parking?
Austin residents hardly agree on the answer to that question. Researchers say while survey respondents all want more transportation options, they disagree on the solutions. Some support improving our use of existing parking stock, while others say we should build more and make it free. There will be more opportunities for public input, and the Downtown Austin Alliance is set to issue an implementation plan for its recommendations in February. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
We did get some fascinating information about Austin's real estate market this week, specifically where all the new homes are being built. Now, first of all, there are a lot of new homes being constructed, the most in 6 years, in fact. That was in the third quarter. Construction started on more than 4,000 homes in the Austin metro area in that little three-month period. Vika O'Grady is with Metro Study Austin, which put out the report. Thank you for your time, Vika.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Nathan.
Tell me, what is going on with housing construction in this market where so many people are struggling to find affordable homes?
For about the third year in a row, the North has been the hottest area of activity, the North submarkets, which include Pflugerville, Round Rock, Georgetown, even Hutto and Georgetown West, and all the way up into Jarrell, are seeing very good, strong home housing activity, new home housing activity. In fact, 8 of the 10 largest or most successful communities are in the North submarket. But there's another area that's actually starting to gain momentum, and that's down in the South submarket, where Buda has really been on fire as well, with quite a bit of housing activity in Buda, and then some new stuff happening in San Marcos.
That matches with what I see just driving around Central Texas, lots of new subdivisions in the suburbs and so on. But why is that happening now? Why is there this big uptick right now?
One of the things that builders are recognizing is that home buyers in Austin generally want to be, if they can be, below $300,000 price point. That's the bulk of the market and has been for years. In fact, it used to be below $200,000. Unfortunately, that market's pretty much disappeared. It's really hard to put a home on the ground below $200,000. What we're seeing is that in order to meet those price points, builders are either having to go further out into the suburbs and or look at building attached housing, condos or townhomes. We actually have more condos and townhomes in our database than we've ever had.
This demand has been around for years, though. We've seen double-digit percentage increases in the median home price, really low inventories, not a lot out there for people to buy, especially in that sub-$300,000 price range you mentioned. Why are builders just now sort of trying to catch up with that demand?
I think what has happened is that there are many more new subdivisions coming online. So, for example, between like 2010 and 2013, we were building out of legacy master plan communities. Well, since that time frame, the number of new communities that have launched, quite a bit of them have come online. And so the supply is starting to catch up, and then the housing starts actually follow the lots, right? So that makes sense.
So what is this going to do, Vika, for the median housing price? Is it going to be easier for people to find affordable new homes? Or does this just depend on, you know, where you look, where in the which submarket, so to speak?
It really depends on the submarket, for sure. As you get further out into the western areas of the Hill Country, it's more expensive to put lots on the ground. And it's harder to put smaller lots on the ground as well. So you're always going to have higher priced housing to the west side of Austin. you know, in the 400s to 600s easily. For those buyers who are looking to stay in sort of the heart of the market, that $250,000 price point, there's a lot of good activity happening, and builders are being more assertive and trying to get homes in at maybe smaller homes, maybe with a few less features than you might have had to do in the past, but to give you more activity below $300,000 as well. It would just be in different submarkets. The other thing that I think is here to stay is that going forward, the first-time home buyer is really likely going to be relegated to purchasing a condo or a townhome going forward. Our market has just matured to the point where it's very hard for a first-time home buyer to get into a single-family home of any size.
All right, Vika, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Vika O'Grady with Metro Study Austin. That, my friend, is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of November 2016. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and send any questions or comments to nathan@kut.org. That's my email. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,